When Scott Young decided to learn the equivalent of an MIT computer science degree without attending the university, many thought it was impossible. Yet within 12 months, he had completed the entire curriculum by focusing on final exams and programming projects, watching lectures at double speed, and testing himself continuously. His MIT challenge went viral, proving that traditional education isn't the only path to acquiring valuable skills. This groundbreaking approach to learning, which Young calls ultra-learning, has since been embraced by thousands seeking to master new skills quickly and effectively. The book has become a favorite among Silicon Valley executives and learning enthusiasts alike, with Bill Gates including it in his summer reading recommendations and Tim Ferriss praising its practical approach to rapid skill acquisition. In a world where the half-life of professional skills continues to shrink, Young's methodology offers a compelling alternative to conventional education's slow pace and high cost. We live in an era where average is over, as economist Tyler Cowen aptly puts it. The middle of the labor market is being hollowed out by automation, outsourcing, and regionalism. Technology has replaced clerks, travel agents, and factory workers while creating demand for engineers, programmers, and designers at the top end. Meanwhile, college tuition has skyrocketed without necessarily teaching the vocational skills needed for high-skilled jobs. Even graduates face significant gaps between academic learning and workplace requirements. This economic reality makes ultra-learning increasingly valuable. The ability to rapidly acquire hard skills creates a competitive advantage in a changing economy, where those who can learn quickly pull ahead of those who cannot. Whether you're looking to accelerate your current career path, transition to a new field, or simply expand your intellectual horizons, ultra-learning offers a powerful alternative to traditional education's limitations. Consider Colby Durant, who accelerated her web development career by learning copywriting through an intensive self-directed project. Or Vishal Maini, who transitioned from marketing to artificial intelligence research in just 6 months of focused learning. Or librarian Diana Fessenfeld, who rescued her career from cutbacks by teaching herself statistics, R programming, and data visualization, transforming from vulnerable to indispensable. While these economic benefits are significant, most ultra-learners are motivated by something deeper than money. Eric Barone created his hit game Stardew Valley from a compelling vision. Roger Craig mastered Jeopardy for the intellectual challenge. Benny Lewis learned languages because he loved connecting with people while traveling. Beyond practical benefits, ultra-learning expands your self-conception and possibilities. The confidence gained from mastering difficult skills opens doors to challenges previously thought impossible. The good news is that ultra-learning doesn't require full-time commitment. It can be applied through part-time projects focusing on intensity rather than hours, during life gaps like unemployment or sabbaticals, or by integrating its principles into existing learning activities. The core strategy is prioritizing effectiveness, whether for a few hours weekly or full-time. Before diving into any learning project, successful ultra-learners invest time in meta-learning, learning about learning itself. While regular learning involves acquiring knowledge, like learning that means fire in Chinese, meta-learning involves understanding how knowledge is structured and acquired within a subject. Linguist Dan Everett demonstrates this brilliantly through monolingual fieldwork, learning unfamiliar languages without translation by mapping language patterns and structure. His approach allows him to become fluent in extremely difficult languages like Pirha by understanding how languages work generally rather than just memorizing words. Research shows bilingual students who formally studied their second language outperform those who simply speak it when learning a third language. This advantage comes from metalinguistic awareness, understanding how language information is structured. While clearest with languages, this principle applies to all subjects. Effective meta-learning research addresses three key questions. Why examines your motivation, allowing you to focus on what matters most. Learning projects typically have either instrumental motivations, serving external goals, like Diana learning statistics to remain relevant in her career, or intrinsic motivations, pursued for their own sake, like learning French because you've always wanted to. What maps the knowledge and abilities needed by breaking them into concepts, requiring deep understanding, facts needing memorization, and procedures requiring practice. After brainstorming, underline the most challenging elements to identify learning bottlenecks. How considers resources and methods using two approaches. Benchmarking, finding common learning approaches by examining curricula or interviewing experts, and the emphasize-exclude method, modifying standard approaches to align with your goals, like focusing on pronunciation rather than spelling when learning French for a vacation. The 10% rule suggests investing roughly 10% of your expected learning time into research before starting, scaling down for very large projects. But meta-learning isn't a one-time activity. Continue researching as you encounter obstacles. The real benefits of meta-learning are long-term, influencing your overall strengths as a learner. Each project teaches you new methods, resource-gathering techniques, time management skills, and motivation strategies. This cumulative effect ultimately outweighs the benefits of any specific project, creating a virtuous cycle where each completed project gives you tools to tackle the next. Mary Somerville achieved remarkable intellectual accomplishments in the 18th century despite facing significant societal obstacles as a woman. Her success wasn't just due to genius, but her exceptional ability to focus deeply despite constant distractions and obligations. She translated and expanded complex mathematical works, learned multiple languages, and became one of the first women elected to the Royal Astronomical Society. Developing focus requires addressing three distinct challenges: getting started, overcoming procrastination, sustaining attention, avoiding distractions, and creating the right kind of focus, matching your mental state to the task. The first challenge, getting started, stems from either craving to do something else or aversion to the task itself. The key is recognizing when you're procrastinating, as much procrastination happens unconsciously. Once aware, develop crutches or mental tools like the 5-minute rule, committing to just 5 minutes of work before taking a break. This often works because unpleasant feelings typically subside after starting. As you improve, graduate to techniques like the Pomodoro method, 25 minutes of focus followed by 5-minute breaks. The second challenge, sustaining focus, requires addressing three sources of distraction: your environment, eliminate multitasking and external interruptions, your task, choose learning methods that engage active thinking rather than passive absorption, and your mind, acknowledge negative emotions without letting them derail you. The third challenge, creating the right kind of focus, involves matching your mental state to the task's complexity. Research shows high arousal creates narrow, intense focus, good for simple tasks requiring concentration, while complex tasks like math problems benefit from a more relaxed, diffuse focus. You can modify your environment to optimize arousal. Sleepy people may benefit from background noise, while well-rested people perform better in quiet settings. Focus isn't exclusive to those with endless free time. Mary Somerville accomplished great scientific work in small time increments. You can improve your ability to focus by starting small and gradually building up. With practice, frustration may transform into genuine interest, and the impulse toward distraction will weaken each time you resist it. Directness means learning skills in contexts closely resembling how you'll actually use them. This principle addresses education's dirty secret, the problem of transfer. Despite a century of study, formal education has largely failed to achieve significant transfer of knowledge from learning contexts to application contexts. Studies reveal disturbing examples. High school psychology students perform no better, sometimes worse, in college psychology than those without prior exposure. College graduates who took economics classes show no advantage in answering economic questions. And physics honors students often can't solve slightly modified versions of problems they've mastered. Ultra learners overcome this problem by designing learning experiences that mirror real application contexts. The simplest approach is learning by doing, spending most time actually practicing the target skill. When direct practice isn't possible, they create environments that replicate the cognitive demands of the real task. What matters most isn't superficial details like room decor, but whether you're making the same kinds of decisions and using the same mental processes. Four powerful tactics emerge from ultralearners' approaches. Project-based learning organizes learning around creating something concrete, guaranteeing practical skill development. Whether programming a computer game, building furniture, or writing a thesis paper, projects ensure you learn how to create that specific output. Immersive learning surrounds you with environments where your target skill is practiced, dramatically increasing both practice volume and exposure to diverse situations. Language learning exemplifies this approach. Living where the language is spoken forces constant practice and exposes you to vocabulary across many contexts. The flight simulator method creates faithful cognitive simulations when direct practice is impossible or impractical. What matters for transfer isn't superficial features, but whether the simulation requires the same decisions and mental processes as the real activity. The overkill approach deliberately increases challenge beyond comfortable levels, ensuring you receive unfiltered feedback. Tristan DeMontebello tested his speeches on middle school students rather than supportive Toastmasters members, because their unfiltered reactions provided honest feedback about what worked. Always ask yourself where and how your knowledge will manifest in real life. Then design learning experiences that connect directly to those contexts. Without this connection, the problem of transfer will likely undermine your efforts. Benjamin Franklin deliberately developed his writing skills through sophisticated practice techniques. He would take notes on articles from the Spectator magazine, wait a few days, then attempt to reconstruct the original argument from memory before comparing his version to the original to identify weaknesses. To expand his vocabulary, he converted prose into verse, forcing himself to find synonyms that matched meter and rhyme. These targeted practice techniques helped him develop the persuasive writing abilities that would later shape the Declaration of Independence. The drill principle works because learning often has rate-determining steps, bottlenecks that control overall performance. By identifying and focusing on these components, progress accelerates faster than practicing the whole skill at once. Drills also reduce cognitive load, allowing focused attention on specific aspects that would otherwise be difficult to improve when juggling multiple components simultaneously. The apparent tension between directness, practicing the whole skill, and drilling, isolating components, can be resolved through the direct-then-drill approach. 1. Practice the skill directly in its natural context. 2. Analyze performance to identify bottlenecks or difficult components. 3. Develop targeted drills for those components. 4. Return to direct practice to integrate improvements and verify the drill's effectiveness. Early learners should cycle quickly between direct practice and drills, while advanced practitioners may spend longer periods on increasingly refined drills as they approach mastery. 5 effective drill types include: time slicing isolates difficult moments within a longer sequence. Musicians practice challenging passages separately before integrating them into the full piece. Cognitive components isolates aspects that normally occur simultaneously. In language learning, grammar, pronunciation, and vocabulary happen concurrently but can be practiced separately. The copycat method involves copying the parts you don't want to drill from others or your past work. Drawing students can practice rendering technique by copying others' drawings. The magnifying glass method involves spending disproportionately more time on the aspect you want to improve, even if it temporarily reduces overall performance. Prerequisite chaining starts with a challenging skill, identifies where you struggle, then goes back to learn the prerequisite skills before trying again. Unlike the mindless drilling often experienced in traditional education, ultra-learning drills are purposeful and self-directed. Rather than being forced to practice without understanding the purpose, ultra-learners identify their own bottlenecks and design creative solutions to overcome them. The power of testing yourself, actively retrieving information from memory rather than passively reviewing it, forms the foundation of the fifth ultralearning principle. This approach was exemplified by mathematical genius Srinivasa Ramanujan, who developed extraordinary mathematical insights by working through theorems without explanations or proofs, forcing himself to derive solutions independently. Research by psychologists Karpakay and Blunt demonstrates that testing yourself dramatically outperforms other study methods like passive review or concept mapping. In their experiments, students who practiced free recall remembered almost 50% more content than other groups. Surprisingly, students consistently underestimate this method's effectiveness, predicting it would be the least effective approach when in fact it proved most powerful. Students avoid retrieval practice because they rely on judgments of learning based on how fluently they process information. When learning feels easy and smooth, as with passive review, students believe they're learning effectively. However, when tested days later, retrieval practice dramatically outperforms passive review. The effectiveness of retrieval practice stems from what psychologist R.A. Bjork calls desirable difficulty. More challenging retrieval leads to better learning, provided the retrieval itself succeeds. Free recall tests, remembering without prompts, outperform cued recall tests with hints, which in turn beat recognition tests like multiple choice. This explains why ultra-learning approaches like speaking a new language from day one work so well. The difficulty of retrieval in real contexts strengthens memory formation far better than classroom review. Five effective retrieval tactics include flashcards. Excellent for paired associations like vocabulary or definitions, especially with spaced repetition systems. Free recall. After reading or lectures, write everything you remember on blank paper, forcing recall of main points and arguments. Question book method. Take notes as questions rather than answers, focusing on big ideas to create retrieval practice material. Self-generated challenges. For skills like programming, create practical challenges that require applying techniques rather than just recalling facts. Closed book learning. Transform any learning activity by removing access to reference materials, forcing retrieval from memory. This pattern appears in biographies of many geniuses. Benjamin Franklin reconstructed essays from memory. Mary Somerville solved problems mentally without candlelight. Roger Craig practiced trivia without looking at answers. Retrieval isn't sufficient for genius, but it may be necessary. Comedian Chris Rock, despite his fame and success, regularly tests new material at small comedy clubs. With scribbled notes in hand, he warns audiences his performance won't be polished. This approach isn't unique. Dave Chappelle, Jon Stewart, and Amy Schumer all test material in intimate venues before major shows. They recognize the critical importance of feedback in refining their craft. Feedback distinguishes ultra-learners from conventional learners through its immediacy, accuracy, and intensity. While most Toastmasters members might speak once monthly, Tristan de Montebello spoke several times weekly at different clubs to gather diverse perspectives. Research on deliberate practice confirms that immediate feedback is essential for expertise. Without it, skills stagnate or even decline, as seen with medical practitioners whose diagnostic abilities worsen over time without proper feedback mechanisms. While feedback's importance seems intuitive, research reveals that more isn't always better. In a meta-analysis by Kluger and Denisi, feedback actually had negative impacts in 38% of cases. The distinction lies in the type of feedback given. Information that guides improvement works well, while feedback aimed at ego, like praise, often harms learning. Even useful feedback must be processed correctly. People may reject it, lower their standards, or give up entirely. Different learning projects require different forms of feedback. Outcome feedback shows overall performance without specifics, providing motivational benchmarks and helping evaluate different learning methods. Informational feedback identifies what's wrong without providing solutions, typically coming through real-time interaction. Corrective feedback shows both problems and fixes, typically from coaches or mentors, making it the most valuable form, though sometimes conflicting advice requires careful filtering. Getting better feedback requires specific tactics. Use noise cancellation by filtering out random factors. Hit the difficulty sweet spot where tasks provide informative feedback without overwhelming you. Use meta-feedback to evaluate your learning strategies. And seek high-intensity, rapid feedback that provides both informational advantages and emotional benefits. Receiving feedback isn't always easy, especially when it feels like an attack on your ego rather than your skills. Though controlling the feedback environment is tempting, it's better to face feedback early and often. With practice, processing feedback becomes easier and less emotionally charged. Memory master Nigel Richards stunned the world by winning the French World Scrabble Championship despite not speaking French. This engineering-minded New Zealander memorized nearly 386,000 valid French word forms in just 9 weeks of preparation. His secret appears to be obsessive intensity combined with active recall. He reads long lists of words while ignoring definitions, then mentally rehearses them during his other passion, long-distance cycling. Memory is essential to learning, whether you're a programmer remembering syntax, an accountant memorizing regulations, or a doctor recalling drug interactions. Yet retention is challenging. Hermann Ebbinghaus discovered the forgetting curve, showing we forget things quickly after learning them, with an exponential decay steepest immediately after learning. Three main theories explain forgetting: decay, memories naturally erode with time; interference, similar memories compete and overwrite each other; and forgotten cues, memories remain but become inaccessible without proper retrieval paths. Ultra learners employ four powerful memory mechanisms to prevent forgetting. Spacing practice over time is crucial. Even simple approaches like weekly conversation practice, later reduced to monthly, can maintain language skills for years. For complex skills, scheduling refresher projects works well despite not being optimally spaced. Proceduralization makes knowledge automatic and more durable. Skills transition from declarative, knowing that, to procedural, knowing how, like typing without thinking about key locations. This suggests focusing intensely on core skills until they become automatic rather than learning everything evenly. Overlearning through practice beyond competence significantly extends retention. This can be achieved either through core practice, continually refining fundamental elements, or advanced practice, moving to higher-level skills that reinforce basics. Mnemonics, like the keyword method for languages, can be powerful but have limitations. They require significant investment, and recall isn't as automatic as direct memory, making them better as intermediate bridges than final solutions. Though forgetting is inevitable, the strategic combination of these approaches can dramatically improve both short and long-term retention. Nigel Richards exemplifies these principles through active recall, spaced rehearsal, and obsessive practice. Richard Feynman was widely regarded as a magician-like genius whose mind worked in inscrutable ways. He could solve problems others had struggled with for months, win mathematics competitions with remarkable ease, and perform seemingly impossible mental calculations. Yet, beneath this magical veneer were explainable techniques. His cube root calculations relied on memorized reference points and interpolation. His lockpicking skills came from obsessive practice and pattern recognition. His physics intuition stemmed from constantly creating concrete examples while others worked with abstractions. Research comparing experts and novices reveals that experts, like Feynman, think in terms of underlying principles rather than superficial features. Chess masters don't calculate more moves, but recognize thousands of patterns instantly. Similarly, Feynman's seemingly magical abilities came from years of playing with mathematical and physical patterns, building a vast mental library that allowed him to see solutions where others saw only complexity. To build Feynman-like intuition, apply four key rules. don't give up on hard problems easily. Feynman was obsessively persistent, often choosing harder calculation methods to deepen his understanding. When tempted to give up, set a timer for 10 more minutes of effort. This not only increases chances of solving the problem, but primes your memory to better retain the solution even if you ultimately fail. Prove things to understand them. Feynman didn't passively absorb knowledge, but worked through it himself. This approach counters the illusion of explanatory depth, our tendency to believe we understand something better than we do. Testing your understanding by trying to prove or demonstrate concepts prevents this self-deception. Always start with a concrete example. Abstract learning rarely works well for humans. We learn general principles only after exposure to many concrete examples. Feynman instinctively knew this, supplying his own concrete examples even when none were given. When you can't imagine an appropriate example, it signals you need to revisit fundamentals. Don't fool yourself. Don't fool yourself, and you're the easiest person to fool, was one of Feynman's favorite sayings. He maintained rigorous standards for what counted as knowledge and was deeply skeptical of his own understanding. Asking simple questions and explaining things clearly prevents fooling yourself into thinking you understand something you don't. The Feynman technique applies these principles by having you write the concept at the top of a page, explain it as if teaching someone else, and when you get stuck, consult reference materials to fill gaps. This forces articulation of ideas, quickly revealing what you don't understand by making you explain concepts in detail. While Feynman's intuitive leaps may seem effortless, beneath his playful style lay tremendous work and dedication. Perhaps his greatest gift was merging tenacious practice with play, approaching both lockpicking and quantum electrodynamics with the same enthusiasm for solving puzzles. Vincent van Gogh became one of history's most celebrated artists, despite starting painting late at 26, lacking natural talent, and facing rejection due to his difficult temperament. His success came through aggressive experimentation, identifying learning resources, methods, or styles, and pursuing them with incredible vigor before moving to new approaches when he hit limitations. Unable to follow traditional artistic training, Van Gogh turned to self-education. He devoured home study drawing courses, copied masters like Millet repeatedly, sketched from life despite his drafting difficulties, and learned from other artists. Van Gogh experimented not just with materials, but with artistic philosophies, shifting from muted gray tones to vibrant colors, from traditional painting to avant-garde styles. His success stemmed from tremendous variety in his experiments and extraordinary intensity, sometimes producing a new painting daily despite constant discouragement. While beginners can follow established paths, experimentation becomes increasingly vital as skill develops for three reasons. First, as you advance, fewer people can teach you, and your needs become more personalized. Second, improvement shifts from accumulating knowledge to unlearning ineffective approaches. Finally, higher-level skills reward originality, not just proficiency. Three types of experimentation drive mastery. Experimenting with learning resources involves testing different methods, materials, and resources. A good strategy is to rigorously apply one resource for a predetermined period, then evaluate its effectiveness before continuing or trying another approach. Experimenting with technique becomes crucial as learning options multiply exponentially with advancement. The approach is similar. Aggressively learn a subtopic, evaluate progress, then decide whether to continue or pivot based on your specific goals. Experimenting with style focuses on developing your own approach once you've matured in your learning. Like Van Gogh, who tried styles ranging from traditional painters to Japanese woodblock prints, you should experiment with different approaches to find what works with your unique strengths. Five key tactics can help integrate experimentation into your learning. Copy, then create. Start by copying work you admire before developing your own style. This simplifies overwhelming possibilities and forces you to deconstruct what makes something work well. Compare methods side by side. apply the scientific method by testing different approaches while varying only one condition, providing clear information about what works best for your personal style. Introduce new constraints. Adding constraints that make old methods impossible forces exploration of new techniques and sharpens underlying skills. Find your superpower in the hybrid of unrelated skills. Rather than pursuing mastery in a single well-defined skill, combine two unrelated skills to create a unique advantage. Explore the extremes. Mathematical principles suggest that in complex, multidimensional skills, optimal approaches are often extreme in at least one dimension rather than moderate across all. The experimental mindset parallels Carol Dweck's growth mindset but takes it further. While growth mindset encourages seeing potential for improvement, experimentation creates active strategies to explore all possible paths to reach that improvement.